1, 2, 3.
Hi, and welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the 30th anniversary of the powerhouse from David Coverdale and Whitesnake.
This is David Coverdale in the studio for the anniversary of the Whitesnake 87 album.
Okay, before we go any further, we need to set the record straight about something. David Coverdale is Whitesnake, and it's always been that way since Coverdale recorded that first solo album in 1977 after Deep Purple broke up. It was as the replacement for popular Deep Purple lead singer Ian Gillan that I first heard David Coverdale's prodigious pipes singing the title song to the album Burn, and it was a great opportunity for the then-unknown Coverdale from Yorkshire, England, to work with one of the most popular hard rock bands in the world in 1973. Here's David Coverdale with me in the studio.
Well, I think I slept with each individual member, actually. I was a lot younger and svelte in those days. Quite honestly, I was working locally in the north of England with bands, and I actually read in a newspaper, a weekly music paper called Melody Maker. It was a picture of John Lord sitting at his organ, you know, with that kind of Monty Python expression. And it said, Deep Purple are still looking for a singer and are considering an unknown. And just then, I was working in a boutique in a place called Redcar on the northeast coast of England. And this guy came in just looking for a shirt or whatever, and he looked at me and asked me, are you still singing, as if, you know, do you still brush your teeth, some kind of flippant, and it was the singly most important thing in my life. So I went back to the Melody Maker, and I thought, why not? That was it. That was all. And I called a friend of mine who booked groups at a local club, and I know Deep Purple had been there, and got all the contact numbers, and he had a chuckle when I said, I'm going to go after the job. Even though he thought I was pretty good, but he just thought, everybody thought it was just out of the realms of possibility. And of course, I had to send a picture down and a tape to the Purple offices in London. And the only picture, I had to borrow one off my mother of me in a scout uniform with the Be Prepared salute, you know. And a guy called Dick Leahy, who ran at that time in England a record company called Bell Records, had heard me on a live radio broadcast, and had paid for me to play, to make some demos with my band in a, you know, recording studio. And I'd never been in a studio before, so I was having a couple of drinks for nerves, and of course my diction was questionable, but I think the tone got me the job. Well, it got me the audition anyway, and I brought the scotch, so I think that was, it was all over bar the shouting. I still practice a great deal of the lessons I learned there. Richie was a great teacher, and predominantly that was the main tutor. I was like his acolyte, and we got on very, very well, and I don't think he ever forgave me for not going and doing that first Rainbow album with him. But I hope we're getting on a bit now, so I sincerely hope we can bury the hatchet, and you know, because I do think of them, you know, fondly now and again. And the world's too small, I think, to carry animosity around. Well, contractually, I was saddled with, sadly, a dinosaur contract with the Purple management, who really couldn't organize a blowjob in a brothel, you know, who were just terribly, terribly lucky. I'll tell you what, you know, Purple was one of the most regarded rock bands in history. And what they wanted to do at one time was release Deep Purple Wallpaper. That's how cool those guys were, you know. And I said, yeah, then maybe, you know, try some toilet paper, perhaps. Have people, you know, use that in memory of Purple. Now, I was led to believe, which later I discovered was entirely false, and there's an expression in England, being led up the garden path. You know, I could have broken contract, but I was led to believe by people who then I trusted that I, you know, I couldn't. So for the first couple of years of Whitesnake, it was pretty uphill.
The dynamic Love Ain't No Stranger from Whitesnake's excellent 1984 album Slide It In. Fronting Whitesnake was a daunting task in the last half of the 70s for David Coverdale. He characterizes it this way.
It was just really stupid, you know, career misguidance. But the very important thing at that in 81, I was extraordinarily frustrated with the way that my career was, and my management was making any and every kind of deal, one-off deals with American labels. Who, you know, for instance, there was a Bob and Jerry Greenberg had Mirage Records. Which was basically a Now You See It, Now You Don't, an aptly named company, you know, yeah, appropriate. And they released, I think, of an album called Come and Get It, they released 30,000 copies, of which I sold more than that in the city of London, you know, so there was never any economic possibility of bringing a band, you know, and a crew to do an American tour. You know, it was just, it would have compromised whatever we were generating everywhere else. So I decided, and then my daughter was extremely ill with bacterial meningitis, which, as you know, is a killer. And I was tortured by this because I was helpless, as you can imagine. But what came out of that was I realized a very simple and basic thing, that there was nothing I could do about her illness, but there were certainly things I could do about my career. So her illness and recovery gave me the balls to turn around and divorce my manager and take over the Whitesnake group of companies, and the rest is history.
Originally from 1984, Slide It In, that's Whitesnake with Slow and Easy.
We were called the Snatch Magnets, I think, on that tour. So it's, forgive me, it's so politically incorrect. He lied.
Up next, David Coverdale faces the brink of disaster for a singer. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with David Coverdale for the 30th anniversary of Whitesnake 87.
Oh, Lord of Beards Red, Lord of Snakes White. Hello, this is David Coverdale in the studio for Whitesnake 87.
Thank you, David. I'm Redbeard. The big hit from Whitesnake 87 was written, recorded, and abandoned much earlier, in 1981. Coverdale's marriage and his relationships with several band members were sinking fast, while his alcohol consumption was on the rise. The song Here I Go Again and its original album, 1982 Saints and Sinners, almost never came out.
Here I go again on my own, that famous country and western tune. Country and Whitesnake. Well, I must tell you, I wrote most of the Saints and Sinners record in the country of Portugal, the very beautiful country of Portugal. I'd taken my wife and child on a writing holiday. That's what I used to do, would be to go away from all, you know, get away from the distractions, rent a house in a nice little corner of the planet, and write and vacation. But sadly, the private scenario was turning into a disintegrating enterprise. So a lot of the themes on that record are documenting, you know, the professional dissatisfaction and the private sadness of a relationship, you know, which you can, you know, just not, neither one saying it's over, you know, hanging on by one's fingernails, and of course because of the child. And it was really, really difficult, but remarkable in terms of inspiration for writing. You know, Crying in the Rain is another song I wrote over there, and that pretty much well sums up the frustration and the lack of communication, and very honest pieces of music, you know. And also, I think it was coming to the end of my overindulging in the peripheral aspects of the rock and roll circus. You know, overindulging, you know, the bits and pieces that I can never understand now when I see people doing it, you know, falling down drunk or comatose, chemically imbalanced. I think the reluctance to own up to age being an indication that recovery is not as immediate as it was before. And the other thing, I was listening to a great deal of my peers, and I heard they were losing their range or their attitude, or, you know, love handles from hell, you know. And, you know, I really have never, ever wanted to become a bloated parody of what I was or conceived to be. So it's just 1% Yorkshire common sense, you know, now and again. I don't, nowadays, I don't really drink anywhere near as much. I'm from the old school, Red. You know, if there's a bottle of wine there, I'll go, why not three? Oh, this must be the last bottle of Hennessy on the planet. I must drink it at one sitting, you know, and then expect to go out and hit those notes, you know, and also set an example to my colleagues. I'm a fan of music, and our entire industry, and people tend to forget this, is rooted, the entire foundation, in songs. Songs that touch people. You know, a song, for instance, like Here I Go Again. When I toured the rest of the world in 94, I was seeing really young people singing this. I'm going, you know what? I've actually written a relevant song in the big picture. You know, so what is the problem here? Why the blinkered perspective? You know, why don't people look at this and not aim for, you know, I have absolutely no aspirations or no dreams. You know, that's for the young lions. That's for the, you know, the new kids on the block, you know. That is not the scenario that I wish to approach. MTV saved me 3 to 5 years of hard touring, you know, with the exposure it gave me. You know, it was a means to an end, you know, and I thank them for the support they gave me or whatever. But the circumstance is, there's more to life than MTV. I want to be the alternative to alternative music, you know? Adrian Vandenberg, who I'd met and found to be a thoroughly charming man and continue to do so, and invited him to participate. Well, you know, he was an admirer of mine, a fan of the band, etc., etc. But at that time, they were experiencing success with a song called Burning Heart in America. So, you know, we've talked about this, obviously, a great deal. He said it tortured him, you know, for a week of going, what should I do? But I could understand, you know, it was his band, his baby, you know, the Vandenberg group. And he had to follow that path. I agree with that, you know. Otherwise, he would have been involved earlier. And the next thing, I think I'd heard this hotshot guitarist called John Sykes, who at that time was working with a fine English band called Thin Lizzy. Who was sadly on the way out. Remember Phil Lynott? You know, great talent, but another one who embraced the peripherals, you know. A great loss. But so I actually engineered having Thin Lizzy on some Monsters of Rock festivals that I was doing in Germany to have a look at him, check him out. And so I invited him to join against the wishes of Cozy Powell. And the rest. And he really didn't have a grasp of the blues at all. He was very hotshot, very fiery, you know. So, you know, that was the initial approach. And as I say, my colleagues weren't overly impressed, but I had a strange feeling that he would come in useful, if you'll excuse the expression. And that proved correct. Musically, he did.
The Whitesnake 87 album is one of the top-selling records of the 1980s, but it's a miracle that it ever came out. Every conceivable stumbling block was placed in David Coverdale's path.
The initial thing that ground to a halt, I must confess, was I developed an appalling sinus infection, which prevented me from singing not only in tune, but without any range at all. Now, I'd started the sessions at the end of 85, and I was singing guide vocals, vibe in the band as we cut in the tracks, and singing like a bitch, you know, it was really happening, and then we stopped for guitar overdubs and stuff, and I did my best to ruin my health in Vancouver. You know, it was quite a party town in those days. But I started to sound very nasal, like I had a cold, but I didn't, you know? I didn't have the symptoms of a cold, but I sounded like it. And the first song I went in for was Is This Love? I thought, I won't overdo it, you know, let's see. And I sang the song from beginning to end, out of tune. And I couldn't tell. And at the end of it, I was dripping with sweat. I was exhausted. And that is not really an exhausting song to perform. So I went to see a couple of specialists in Vancouver, and they said, you know, oh, you've got a cold, blah, blah, blah. And it was just terribly frustrating. I called my manager, Howard Kaufman, and John Kolodner at Geffen, and said, look, they've recommended I have a couple of weeks, you know, get some sun on my chest, dry my sinuses, et cetera, et cetera. So we pulled the plug and went back, you know, to our assorted homes for a couple of weeks. And at that time, I was living in a hotel called the Mondrian in Los Angeles. So I would go and, you know, lay in the sun and stuff, and I was getting more and more nasal. So my manager sent me to Dr. Edward Cantor, who I strongly believe to this day saved my career, and he turned into a very good friend, etc. And within seconds, he put a small flashlight into my mouth, put the lights off in the his surgery, put the flashlight on, and he went, "Oh my God, this is the worst sinus infection I've ever seen." And he said, "No, I'm surprised you can even talk." So the initial, I said, "Well, look, I'm behind on a project." He recommended surgery, which of course frightened me to death. What had happened? I was born with a deviated septum, and it decided to collapse on me. And it was not drug related in any way, although I'm sure certain aspects of the 70s didn't help. But that was his major recommendation. But because I was in the middle of a project and behind, he put me on a course of an antibiotic called Keflex for 6 weeks. And it actually, and I didn't drink for, you know, that was the first time, you know, I came to terms with sobriety, which I thought was pretty happening, you know. I was looking good in the skin, etc. So 6 weeks later, I get the clean bill of health. Sykes, Stone, and I fly down to Barbados. Compass Point. Where? Bahamas, for God's sake. Yeah, the Bahamas. So, you know, and within the week of him giving me a clear bill of health, a week to the day that I started to sing, the infection had flooded back in. And I came back and prepared for surgery, and the 50-50 chance I'd never be able to perform again. Well, one of the indications, I must say, I received absolutely no support from my partner, Sykes, at that time. In fact, I was mortified that he did everything he could to take advantage of my being compromised. But I must tell you, the only thing I can compare it with is castration. The idea of not being able to do it ever again would really compromise the joy of living. I tried as a thinking person to come to terms with the idea that I could still write, I could still produce and express myself through that, but of course somebody else would be singing my songs, you know? It was a dreadful, dreadful, dreadful 86.
Next, David Coverdale shows you how to rock yourself out of $3 million in debt. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with David Coverdale for the 30th anniversary of Whitesnake 87.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I sound like a weatherman. Helena got 6 inches last night. Hey, if it ain't stiff, it ain't worth a fuck. Right? Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm David Coverdale of Whitesnake talking to Redbeard.
David Coverdale would have the sinus surgery that could save his voice or seal his fate. Which would it be? After time to let it heal, there was only one way to find out. I asked David Coverdale how he felt the first time in the studio stepping up to the microphone after surgery.
I'm afraid I was the only one. I was the only snake in residence. Well, I've got to tell you, extremely nervous, you know, indescribably nervous. I mean, I don't think there's a word for it. Olsen was great. He said, "Let's just have a couple of run-throughs." I said, "What do you want to start with?" He said, "Still of the Night," which I almost vomited. You know, you can't be serious. He says, I won't record it or whatever. And I sang the song twice, you know, and just fingers crossed. And that's what's on the record. Yeah, it's a blend of two passes. And then he went, "I think we've got that one." And because I thought I was just doing run through, so there wasn't the psychological weight that I was going for it.
So with the lengthy Whitesnake 87 project completed and ready for release by March 1987, David Coverdale took inventory. He had no band and a staggering mountain of debt. Listen closely to just how much.
Okay, so I come back from spending Christmas with my daughter. I'm really pretty much deflated. I'm $3 million in debt. $3 million. I had written out the names of Adrian Vandenberg, Vivian Campbell, Rudy Sarzo, and Tommy Aldridge. You know, if it looked like I was going to get a band together, these are the people I thought would be good. Vivian to recreate the American style guitar hero syndrome. Adrian to play the more traditional, memorable guitar, you know, a la Beck, you know. And Rudy and Tommy, who actually we'd approached to be the rhythm section on the 87 album, and to their eternal regret, I think, or remorse, you know, they didn't do it. Whatever. But they did very well with us later. And of course, when it came to shoot the videos, I called the guys and asked if they'd want to be involved under the name of The Vid Kids. You know, we shot 3 videos in 2 weeks, which was Still of the Night, Here I Go Again, and Is This Love. And things just went nuts then.
In the 30 years since original release of Whitesnake 87, the album has sold way more than 15 million copies. David Coverdale reflects on the popularity of the song that was almost never released the first time.
That was the hard part, because we had the tune, and the middle part, I just didn't want, you know, where you would look upon a solo, I just didn't want to do the normal stuff. I'm a big classical fan, and I love symphonic arranging without it coming across as that pompous symphonic stuff, just to make it interesting. The actual middle piece of Still of the Night originally was the intro for a song called Looking for Love, which for the life of me, I could never understand why Colonna didn't put it on the 87 album. That was my favorite song. And he said, oh, no, no, no. I said, you're going to put Children of the Night on over Looking for Love? I can't believe it. That was, my first number one record in this country. It was absolutely wonderful. Look at that number two business. I had enough of that with the album. We were at number two for, 6 months? You know, and while all of these number ones, Dirty Dancing and Dirty Somebody or whatever, or Filthy Bopping, they, whatever it was, you know, were coming and going, you know, but they would always have this flush of hot sales, but we were just anchored there. And of course, MTV, you know, I got relatively tired of seeing myself on there, you know, as did a lot of people, I think, because we just turned into these darlings. And of course, the only downside I feel of that, which was the only time, basically subconsciously, I think, that I embraced a fashion presentation, as opposed to basically being stylized in what I do, which of course was the big hair and the decorated like a overt, you know, Christmas tree clothes. And I think that disappointed a lot of my hardcore people, what one could call the Americanization of Whitesnake, or the media, you know. And then I found, of course, that people were grouping me in those heavy metal cartoon magazines, you know, with groups that really I've never felt any affiliation to. You know, a lot of the 80s darlings. But, you know, I look at the pictures and I go, well, that's easily confusing, you know. We look like that. But I was sitting with Page in my, Jimmy Page in my home when we were writing the Coverdale Page record, and my manager called and said, are you ready for this? He said, sit down. I said, what? He said, you've just sold another 2 million records. And then a month later, there was another mill on top of that. It was a remarkable reward. And I was at a time of a maturity that I accepted it with great dignity, I felt, which has always been a passion of mine, to be able to accept things with dignity and grace. And it just felt like a wonderful pat on the back.
I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this.